Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, November 1st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing, among other things, telecommunications regulation with some focus on the overlap and cooperation of regulation at the federal and state levels. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome today's call four experts. We've got three panelists and a moderator. I will introduce the moderator. He'll then introduce the panelists, and they'll have some discussion back and forth between and among them. But then ultimately, as always, we'll be returning to the audience, or turning to the audience, I should say, for questions. So as you listen to their initial remarks, please be thinking of your questions. And with that, I want to welcome our moderator, Gregory Sopkin, who's a partner at the law firm here in Washington, Wilkinson, Barker, and Auer. And even more importantly, from my perspective, he's a member of the Federalist Society's Telecommunications Practice Group Executive Committee and has been a leader and volunteer for our organization for some years. And with that, Mr. Sopkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you to the panelists for joining us today. Today we're going to have an informal discussion about how federal and state regulation over telecommunications should and can be shared as the transition from circuit-switched telephony to Internet protocol telephony is completed. I will solicit questions from the call-in audience as well as ask questions myself. The panelists we have today are three panelists, Chairman Dave Danner, President Paul Shalander, and Free State Foundation Randy May. I will do a brief introduction now of each of them. I hope they don't mind if I truncate their bio a little bit so we have a productive discussion today. Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State appointed Dave Danner Chairman of the Utilities and Transportation Commission in February 2013. Dave has been a telecommunications attorney in private practice, so we are very happy to have him today and to listen to his thoughts here. He is counsel to the Washington Senate Energy and Utilities Committee and senior policy advisor at the Washington State Department of Information Services. He has a BA from Columbia, an MA in communications from the University of Washington, and a law degree from GW, so he's much more credentialed than most of us. moving on to Paul Shalander. Paul rejoined the Idaho Public Utilities Commission in April 2011 following a stint as administrator of the Office of Energy Resources. He also served on the Idaho Commission previously, so he has a recidivism problem here. Shalander serves as the Idaho Commission president, and he was appointed to his current six-year term by Idaho Governor Butch Otter. Shalander's undergraduate degree is from Muskingum College in Ohio in communication, psychology, and art, and he has a master's in telecom from Ohio University. Unfortunately, he is a soccer fan, but we will forgive that for now. Randy May is the Free State Foundation's president. It's a leading D.C. think tank. The scholars of the Free State Foundation have decades of experience in the public policy arena and academic settings promoting free markets, secure property rights, and individual liberty. Randy is a nationally known legal and policy expert in the field of regulation, as well as a widely recognized expert in communications, administrative, and constitutional law. So with that, I'm going to start with this discussion, and the heading of this discussion again is cooperative federalism. And I think the best way to start with that is perhaps the person who may have coined that term, and that's our own CU Law School Dean, Professor Phil Weiser. And he called cooperative federalism, he set forth this definition. Cooperative federalism programs set forth some uniform federal standards as embodied in statute, federal agency regulations, or both, but leave state agencies with discretion to implement federal law supplement it with more stringent standards, and in some cases, receive an exemption from federal requirements. This power allows states to experiment with different approaches and tailor federal law to local conditions. So what we have here is the Telecommunications Act of 1996, where Congress did not clearly delineate the jurisdictional relationship between federal and state authority. And in Iowa, AT&T versus Iowa Utilities Board, the Supreme Court made clear that the 1996 Act's new requirements did follow that principle of cooperative federalism. However, we have a quote from Justice Scalia that seems to make clear that the FCC retains the ultimate authority. He said in a footnote, "The appeals by both Justice Thomas and Justice Breyer to what might loosely be called states' rights are most peculiar, since there is no doubt, even under their view, that if the federal courts believe a state commission is not regulating in accordance with federal policy, they may bring it to heel. This is at bottom a debate not about whether the states will be allowed to do their own thing, but about whether it will be the FCC or the federal courts that draw the lines to which they must hew." So that's the Supreme Court's view, at least from that decision. That was the majority opinion. And the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissions, NARUC, released their Federalism Task Force report called Cooperative Federalism and Telecom in the 21st Century. And I believe that Paul Schlander is a vice chair on the NARUC Federalism Task Force. And they released their report in September 2013 out of the last NARUC meeting. And in the report, and I swear I'll get to the question in just a minute here, in the report, the task force had a little bit of a concern with what's happening with federal encroachment on state authority. It says, "While the states, NARUC, and other parties file written comments on proposed rules, it appears the FCC often focuses its efforts more on the information provided in ex parte submissions that occur at the end of the comment cycle and or on written submissions that are made after the end of the formal comment and reply comment period than on earlier submissions. NARUC members have expressed serious concerns about whether this practice presents all interested parties with an adequate and timely opportunity to respond, particularly for those parties without a presence in Washington, D.C." So the question is, for services that are not purely intrastate, what regulation services can be provided by states that the FCC, because it lives in D.C., may not be as well equipped to handle? And let me start with Paul Schlander. Paul?
Thank you. Thank you, Greg, for I think that introduction, which kind of helped tease up at least where state regulators' concerns grew from. I don't want to monopolize a lot of time, but I do want to just add a little bit more background into why that task force on federalism was created. In large part, Phil Jones, a commissioner and a colleague of Dave Danner's from Washington, is now the president of NARUC. And Phil believed, based on what he had seen as far as the FCC's relationship with the states, was that, in fact, there was no working relationship. So when you get to the clear-cut definition of what cooperative federalism is, it appeared, at least in the area of telecommunications, that had completely and totally fallen apart. So what Commissioner Jones had hoped would occur was that with this task force, we begin to redefine just how to perhaps rebuild some of those bridges that seem to have been blown up. And I don't think either side should take credit for having kept that bridge open. I think we all played our role in destroying those relationships. What really helped, I think, move things along was the fact that there was and is a sea change at the FCC. I believe it was just yesterday or earlier this week that two new commissioners got confirmed at the FCC by the Senate, and one of those is the new chairman, which we hope signals an opportunity for us to improve the dialogue and relationship with the FCC and the states. When you look specifically at the problems that we had, and you mentioned the Federal Act, I mean, when you look at the joint boards that were created in the Federal Act, it clearly says that certain pieces of the puzzle need to be referred to those joint boards, and none of that was happening. And so, as you could probably imagine, there are a lot of attorneys who are also public utilities commissioners who saw what was happening as a direct violation of law. And they got up on their heels on it, and I think deservedly so. So now the key issue is going forward. What do we really want in terms of cooperative federalism? I don't think anybody believes that referring something to a joint board or a task force requires the FCC to have to accept what we return back in a white paper or a report or a recommendation with any more weight that they would give any other party to a case. I don't think anybody assumes that. All we really want is what you described earlier, is that opportunity to be heard realistically, as opposed to having 50 different states trying to file comments into a record at the federal level. As you know, as an attorney representing clients, and it's not an easy task to follow all the things that are happening at the federal level, and that's where these joint boards and task forces really do provide some tremendous benefit to the states. That said, trying to directly answer your question, I think going forward, when we look at the changes that are happening in technology, the issues that I think are probably the most important for the states to be actively engaged in are consumer complaints, conflict resolution, and emergency preparedness. I see those as significant and important. I'd add to that call completion. We have a lot of rural carriers. We've seen a lot of things that have been going south as it relates to call completion in the last few years. We see the FCC jumping on board and beginning to take some action there, but I would say those are probably the big ticket items as it relates to me. Again, thank you for the opportunity to participate, and thanks for letting me go first and steal all the good stuff.
Which I'm sure you, Dave, appreciate. Dave, you are a telecommunications attorney. Where do you see the division of responsibilities in terms of the states versus the FCC?
Well, thank you. I going second after Paul, it does mean that my remarks are going to be shorter because he covered a lot of it. I think that Phil Weiser's definition is the one that I embrace. I think that he kind of laid it out. And really what it gets to is that the term cooperative federalism requires an element of cooperation. It has to be cooperative. And so the FCC has to recognize that. And I think that the new members on the FCC, I'm very optimistic that they will. It also means that the states, as Paul said, we don't have offices in near the FCC. We're not visiting them regularly. It's hard to even keep up with what's in the trade press. And so we use NARUC as our eyes and ears in D.C. They follow a lot of these things, the joint boards. We have to be involved, but the FCC basically has to make sure that they're giving us an audience. They could also, it's not just a matter of getting us an audience, it's giving us some clarity. I would like them to kind of specify what their expectations are of us, and sometimes that's murky. But I agree with Paul. I think the issues for the states are consumer protection, interconnection, designating the eligible carriers under 254, some numbering things, and public safety. And other than that, I think that economic regulation is going away altogether, so we don't really need to determine whether that's going to be a state or a federal matter, because that's going to be a smaller part of the pie.
Well, thank you, Dave. Let me turn to Randy May now. Randy, you may have a unique view because you live in that crucible known as Washington, D.C. What do you have to say on this subject?
Thanks, Greg, and thanks for inviting me. And I will say I live just outside the Beltway, and I'm speaking from just outside the Beltway. So, I want to make that clear. And, I don't think my view is so unique, but I think it'll be useful. I want to go a little further back in history, perhaps, as a backdrop, because there may be people on the call that aren't quite as familiar with all these topics and the current proceedings as we are. And since this is the Federalist Society, I think it's useful just for context, and I think my co-panelists will agree with this. They're really sort of, at least to my mind, and the way I think about approaching this issue in a large sense, is there are two constitutional values that are important. On the one hand, there's federalism, which is obviously part of the structure of our Constitution, and federalism notions were imported into the Communications Act, and there's also the interstate commerce. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about, and in the final analysis, as a legal matter, where their jurisdiction lies really relates to the federal authority under the Interstate Commerce Clause. And so with those things in mind, I mean, the other thing I want to sort of say at the outset, and it then I think will, be a segue into the more particular issues that Dave and Paul sort of set forth in a list, but also sort of with history in mind. When I was actually at the FCC in from 1978 to 1981 as associate general counsel at the time, and that was in the middle of the FCC's computer proceedings when it was trying to deal with the environment at that time and the beginning of the merging of basically data services and more pure telecom services. And the point is there were major battles between the states and the feds over jurisdiction, and they related, for example, to things like regulation of terminal equipment, which were subject to both state and federal regulation. And, they led to Supreme Court cases like Louisiana Public Service Commission to determine whether the FCC could dictate, for example, in that case, depreciation rates to the states over this equipment that was subject to joint regulation. But the point really is that now, if you take that point in time and then look at where we are now as a result of the transition from circuit switch networks to, an IP environment, if we want to call it that, or the internet world or digital age, the transition to basically IP services, which I think we'll all agree probably that it's, at least the FCC has said that it's, and so far the courts have upheld it, that it's not practical, or it's impractical, if not impossible, to make jurisdictional determinations in the way that we did back in the old days, that in this new era there's necessarily been a sea change, and the big point is, and I think if Paul or Dave, touched on this, they mentioned economic regulation is not likely going to be the area where there's going to be a conflict, and the real point is that most of the economic regulation has been basically at the federal level, and the state regulation reduced so much that's not where the likely disagreements will be, and so the range, so the scope for engaging in cooperative federalism, in my mind, and as someone who has federalist society or federalist disposition in terms of recognizing the positive role that states can play in a lot of areas, and particularly as, quote, the laboratories of, for experimentation, the area of disagreement, I think, is less, and there is an important role for the states to play, but it's not, to my mind, in the type of economic regulation that we associate with the old traditional common carrier principles.
Well, and building off of that comment, Randy, let me ask Dave this question as a telecommunications attorney. So Dave, you indicated that there should, where the line should be drawn is states should tilt should still have a role with regard to consumer protection, interconnection, and public safety issues. But yet we have a little bit of a legal issue that still remains, and that relates to the Vonage decisions, the Vonage versus Minnesota PUC decisions, in which a district court in Minnesota and the Eighth Circuit upheld that state commissions do not have entry or economic regulatory authority over nomadic VoIP services, as distinguished from fixed VoIP. And so we still have this question about what jurisdiction states may have over fixed VoIP. And here we're talking about, primarily cable kind of services, who really have been the biggest, in terms of landline services, have been the biggest competitor to the Baby Bells, to the incumbent local exchange carriers, and have, received a fair amount of market share. And so we've had this issue play out over a number of state commissions, and I'm not sure if this issue has played out in Washington or Idaho, but some states have taken some steps to say, well, fixed VoIP sure looks the same to us as, the traditional circuit switched telephone services, and so we're gonna say that some of our regulations apply there, and yet it hasn't really been carried out even in those states, because either the states backed off or the state legislatures just deregulated state commission jurisdiction over IP, or largely deregulated, even including the state of California, which California wasn't too happy about it. So I guess a couple questions. Is there any real distinction between fixed and nomadic VoIP that should call for regulatory distinctions? And is fixed VoIP so similar to traditional circuit switch telephony that it would be unfair not to regulate them in the same way as circuit switched?
Well, yeah, it's a great question, but it's not one. In Washington State, basically, we're trying to treat all the telecom services on a level playing field. And so our two largest landline telephone companies have been largely deregulated. We have Frontier Communications is now been competitively classified. We have before us right now an alternative form of regulation petition from CenturyLink. And I expect the result of that is that they are also essentially going to be competitively classified. And so now we're down to how are we dealing with the rural companies. So really, if we want to say, are we treating the fixed VoIP the same as we're treating the landlines? Yes, basically we are, because we're taking a very light approach to it all. The only difference that I can see is really one of convenience, that by not conceding that fixed VoIP is the same as nomadic VoIP, it allows us to retain the jurisdiction to do some of the consumer protection and interconnection activities that we do. But again, if we had some clarity from the FCC on this, I think it would be a matter that would be easily resolved. We don't really see, I mean, technologically, I don't see a difference between nomadic and fixed VoIP, and I think that this is all something that should be resolved easily by figuring out the structure going forward.
Greg, this is Randy. Can I jump in for a second?
You bet.
Follow Dave, and I appreciate what Dave said, and I think his comments actually I think reinforce my point about as economic regulation shrinks, because policymakers at whatever level recognize the when you have more competition, then you don't want to engage in that type of economic regulation. That's a good point. But I think, though, when you're leading up to the question, Greg, you identified something that I think is important going forward, at least from my perspective, and for telecom policy, and ultimately, I think, a new communications act, because it is true, I think, that this, from a consumer's perspective, whether it's nomadic VoIP or fixed VoIP or something else, these services, you know, may look the same, and they're obviously substitutable services in terms of analyzing a market's competitiveness. But of course, that's not, you know, that's not the way the Communications Act is structured in terms of determining ultimate jurisdictional authority. You've got these, you really have, you know, jurisdictional determinations, you know, I think that are based to largely on, you know, what I would call techno-functional constructs, either functional characteristics or technology. So ultimately, when we get to a new Communications Act down the road, I'd like to see, you know, more of an analysis that's sort of an antitrust-like and based on consumer perspective, but that's not the case. I think what, and Dave was referring to, I believe it's still true, but Paul or Dave will correct me, the FCC has had open for about 7 years now or so this proceeding called the IP, Internet Protocol-enabled, you know, services proceeding. And
Randy,
I think
it's 13 years.
Is it? Well, whatever it is, it's, you know,
yeah,
been
it's
a long
while.
Time. Even by the FCC standards, it's been a while. and you know, I believe a central issue in that proceeding is, you know, the jurisdictional status of, you know, these what we would call the interconnected voice services or VoIP services. So it hasn't, you know, for whatever the reason, it hasn't answered that. But, I mean, it hasn't resolved that question. But I think what's happened, and I think maybe Dave was suggesting this too, and so, you know, we really do have probably a lot of agreement there. Over time, in all those years, while the FCC has just, you know, held that proceeding open, at least in my view, the marketplace is becoming more competitive. It's finding ways to work with the states on things like E911 and, you know, maybe universal service, and without coming down and making this hard and fast jurisdictional ruling. But I will say, from my perspective, I hope if it ever does rule in that case, I think there's a basis to say that the fixed VoIP services are interstate services and subject to the FCC's, you know, exclusive jurisdiction. But you know, I think at the time it does that, it won't matter, you know, necessarily as much, and maybe we'll be in the happy, really into the happy age of cooperative federalism in a positive way from my viewpoint.
And maybe we're already there. And Paul, let me ask you this, since you're presumably one of the authors of the Federalism Task Force report, there's a statement in there that says, it's on page 8, to further ensure this cooperation, and here we're talking about the cooperation between states and the feds, the FCC should determine the regulatory status of VoIP and other IP-enabled services. Until there is a decision on this issue, questions about the responsibility for ensuring that communication services remain safe, reliable, and ubiquitously available, including interconnection, will remain unanswered. And I guess my question is, do we really want an answer to that question from the FCC? I mean, if it's a hard, states have no jurisdiction, or, you know, the contrary, states have plenary jurisdiction, do we really want to hear this? Right now, we seem to be in this, for lack of a better term, maybe a happy place, where there is a threat of regulation that makes cable telephony carriers do good things, good in quotation marks, like informal complaint discussions, contribute to state high cost fund, 911 cooperation. And even with that, the FCC has sort of done some ad hoc carve-outs, saying that states should be allowed to do certain things with VoIP carriers, such as 911 contributions to the USF and state high cost funds. Well, what's your thought on that, Paul?
I'm like anybody else in the regulatory environment, whether I'm a party to a case, a regulator, an attorney representing somebody. All I want is clarity until I get it, and then I've maybe got some issues. But when I look at it from, you know, from exactly the description you described, is in some senses the FCC has already made those carve-outs. Why not go ahead and put your names to it and call it a day and give us that clarity and we'll move on and get the job done. I mean, when you look at what consumers see, consumers don't see the difference between fixed, nomadic, or two cups in a string. They don't care. What they care about is being able to pick up the phone, make a call, have it be completed, and in the case of an emergency, have enough backup power so they can let somebody know that they're on the roof or they're okay. At the end of the day, what the consumers really care about, I'm not afraid of the clarity. I might not like it at the end of the day, but I'm going to learn how to live with it. And as long as they involve the states in the process, it's not as if we didn't have a voice in it. And again, if we can get to that point where cooperative federalism actually works, and we have that opportunity to participate, there's a chance that some of our concerns or carve-outs or waivers can be included in whatever the final outcome is. When I look at where a lot of regulators had some real issues with regards to the shift in universal service support to broadband, I don't know that it was necessarily that they think that the FCC was wrong to say that universal service for broadband ought to be something essential. I think a lot of it was just the part that they felt closed out of the participatory process. That was a big piece of it. And so, again, going forward, as long as you're involved in the process and you end up with the end result and it's not just completely and totally wacky, I think we move on. And as a check and balance, let's say the FCC gets it wrong. And I realize that what I'm saying might be blasphemy or at least ludicrous. We still have Congress, and they do have certain opportunities in which they can weigh in and change something if they feel that one of these agencies got it wrong. It's called passing legislation. So at the end of the day, I guess I'm not afraid of the process having an opportunity to work. Are you correct that in this area or this era of ambiguity and lack of clarity that things are moving forward? They are. Things have moved forward very well without having to have somebody put that stamp of final approval over it. But there comes a point at which some of these things are glimpses into the intuitively obvious. Why not go ahead and put a stamp on those issues and then move on? That's just a general thought, and I'm okay if somebody disagrees.
Well, this notion of having clarity, I'm not sure all of us lawyers are for that, but let me ask a little different question. In the Federalism Task Force report, there's a bullet point on goals, ensuring that networks remain ubiquitous and interconnected regardless of communications technology or end user location. Some states have been looking into the same thing that the FCC has done with the USF ICC transformation order, and that is getting into the world of broadband. Broadband is now regarded by many states as a necessity akin to having a telecommunications service. Is this an area that state commissions should wade into in terms of the first issue is providing support either through state high-cost funds or administration of the federal funds. And with that, should there be some strings attached and do the states thereby have some responsibility over service quality and things like that? Let me start this with Randy May.
Well, I was afraid you were going to start with me, Greg. But, you know, my view is really, let me just state a couple of things broadly with regard to universal service and then, you know, talk about which level of jurisdiction should do what. But you know, I've been pretty critical of the federal, you know, the federal fund and you know, the way USF has been rolled out. Now, and I'm wary, I'm wary of seeing an expansion of the fund, you know, just so that the amount of money, the amount of distributions grow, because ultimately, as you know, it's paid for through a tax, you know, quote, fee on, you know, consumers, and but at the same time, I'll just add, you know, for the benefit of everyone, that I've actually been a longtime supporter of sort of Lifeline, the program, because although there are a lot of abuses that need to be cleared up and reform there, but to me it's a much more targeted way to get support to people that really need the support. So, but having said that, I mean, I can see a role for the states because they are closer, to the people in terms of knowing the regions and the areas and their states that need support. So, you know, I'm certainly not averse to them having a role, but I sort of think of it in terms of, akin to block grants that are used, in other areas where the federal government, gets money down to the states, but then, does it through some block grant type of process and then has guidelines as to how the money should be used, certain guidelines, but also leaves certain discretion to the states to allocate those resources. So, just speaking, more broadly at this point, I mean, that type of framework, might work for me, but I'm not in favor of having the universal service funds really grow willy-nilly to support broadband services, as opposed to much more targeted subsidies to people that really, really need the support.
Okay, Dave Danner?
Yeah, well, our role so far in broadband at the Utilities Commission here in Washington has not really been all that significant, and the network has seemed to have grown without our involvement. Now, we've had some cases where companies have merged, and in order to get approval, they've made some concessions with other parties and settlements to deploy more broadband in rural areas. But other than that, we haven't been that involved there. But it has grown. I do think I agree that there's a role. It's the same role in any telecom service. The states are kind of we're closer to the consumer, and so there are some areas where it makes sense for us to be involved. Again, consumer protection, matters of public safety, interconnection, so I think again that if the FCC would basically decide how it wants to regulate and determine what the roles are for the states, then we can have that conversation. I think that in terms of having a big universal service fund, right now I'm seeing that customers in Washington State are pretty well served, except in really remote areas that we can target. They're really not that many as you might think, and I think that we can do it pretty quick without setting up the kind of universal service bureaucracy that we've had in the past.
Okay, and final word on this, Paul.
Thanks. I fall in line pretty closely with Dave in many respects, and I do want to see some clarity because it makes it easier for us to do our jobs, and when it gets down to that issue, it's not going to be us doing that job within our commission walls. It's going to be trying to provide some advice to our legislature for them to determine what path to go, whether or not to change our state universal service fund support to include broadband deployment, and to maybe help have some clarity as it relates to what are considered to be critical services as opposed to critical infrastructure. And I think that really should be where a lot of the focus is. What are the critical services that we think people need to have in order for health, safety, and the ability to have commerce and industry transpire within the state's borders? Have that discussion about what critical services are, and maybe move away from just everybody has to have this same comparable ubiquitous coverage, because in a state like Idaho that has a lot of shielding or terrain that shields access even via satellite for broadband deployment, there are certain areas that regardless of how much money you spend will never be served in a manner that is reasonably comparable to areas like our capital city, as a case in point. So, I think again, that clarity at the federal level will help us. And, you know, my concern, too, is about the current Universal Service Fund being sort of capped and then allowing new providers to come in and take money out to provide services that were never envisioned when you created that initial Universal Service Fund support. So I think the issue of contributions, and I hate to beat that drum over and over again, needs to be discussed. I mean, we're looking at a lot of services that have been contributing to Universal Service that are basically, they're on a death spiral. And you can't assume that money is going to continue to flow in. And so I think the issue, if you're going to have Universal Service support, Universal Service support for broadband, and you don't include broadband providers or customers of current broadband as part of that contributions, you're going to have a failed scenario that is just simply not going to work. But I think you also have to have the realization that ubiquitous coverage might be something that is just not possible. And there are some areas that just, it's uneconomic under any circumstance, because just because you can throw money at those areas with block grants or other things to build that system, somebody still has to operate it. And therein lies the difficulty, because unless those subsidies continue forever and ever, amen, those things won't thrive economically. And then what do we do when the next significant technological jerk comes along and we still haven't recovered the costs of those systems? So I'm a little leery of seeing things develop in that way. I think there has to be some kind of economic test. And unfortunately, I think when you do that, you recognize that there are going to be some areas that simply it doesn't make sense.
So this is Dave. If I may follow up with just an example in Washington, we have a community in Washington where they have received USF funding that basically totals about $10,000 per subscriber a year is the subsidy they're getting. And since they built out, we've looked at what the cost of a satellite would be to serve that community, and it's, you know, it's a couple of $100 a month. And so, that's exactly the kind of scenario I think that Paul is describing.
Well, excellent points all, and certainly we have very similar issues here in Colorado as in Idaho and Washington State. I think it's probably a good time to turn it over for any of the listening audience, questions they may have. Dean, can you make that happen?
Of course. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And before we go to our first caller, let me make a quick programming announcement. Next week, as the Supreme Court resumes its argument calendar, we have 5 Teleform conference calls to offer. On Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the Sandifer Donning and Doffing case being argued that day in the Supreme Court. On Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, the Bond case argued on Tuesday. That's on the extent of authority of Congress under the treaty power versus the Commerce Clause and other enumerated powers. Then on Wednesday at 2 p.m., Town of Greece, which concerns legislative prayer, being argued in the Supreme Court, and we'll have a Teleform conference call discussing that oral argument and the case generally. Thursday, we'll have another book Teleform conference call with author Peter Schweitzer at noon. And then on Friday, at a very special early hour, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, it's a wake-up Teleform conference call for those of you on the West Coast, we'll have another Courthouse Steps Teleform, this one on the Medtronic case concerning the burden of proof in some of the patent litigation cases. Greg, we've got 2 callers with questions right now, so let's go to our first caller.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Andy Klein. I'm an attorney in private practice, but a former attorney with the New York Public Service Commission. I wanted to return to the concept of cooperative federalism and what that indicates for the roadmap going forward. You know, as we all know, the 271 process under the 96 Act was a model for federal and state cooperation. had a federal statute with a checklist of requirements for open markets, for competition, had state involvement and DOJ involvement written into the statute. But at that time, the FCC was unable or at least unwilling to define the specifics of what those market opening mandates were. And I ran at the time the New York 271 proceeding, which ended up defining what those parameters were. We realized the FCC's limitations. We undertook to define the specifics, and we actually set up working groups that included FCC and DOJ personnel. The FCC ended up pulling back from the individual groups, but we kept in close contact with the FCC nonetheless. And the DOJ remained directly involved, including our friend Phil Weiser. And that became, of course, a very successful process. New York became the first state to have 271 entry and to open up the market to competition. But since that time, the FCC has pulled back from cooperative federalism, which to me undercuts the concept of federalism itself. Going forward, you know, in my view, the FCC needs to move beyond the inside the beltway mentality of DC knows best. And simply because the technology is changing doesn't mean that all regulation should become federal. You know, there's states not only laboratories of democracy, but laboratories of technology in many respects. And the states are simply better structured to handle the discrete issues through their hearing processes, for example. But I think at the same time, the states have to be careful to ensure they're operating fairly and without undue political influence that, that may favor the huge legacy bell companies or other big ILECs. So I guess, you know, in the question is, to the extent to which that model that was established under the 96 Act can help define the path forward in terms of federal and state cooperation in the areas, you know, such as universal service and advanced service regulation, some of the areas you've been discussing previously.
Greg, this is Randy. Can I take a quick stab at that and then have the others join in? But, you know, one thing I want to say in reaction to Andrew's comments, and I was a witness at the House hearing about a week ago on the IP transition, and we heard this a lot, that the assertion that just because technology is changing doesn't mean that regulation changes, and or, you know, something to that effect. And, you know, I think, you know, that's fair enough, but the reality is, and I think the more fundamental point is because of the technological changes and what I would say technological advances, what it's really meant is that competition has been enabled and we have more competition. And it's the fact that the marketplace has changed that really means that the regulation should change. And you know, again, has changed quite a bit as the state commissioners have acknowledged as well. So that's really the, you know, the point. And then more specifically on the, you know, the 271 process, 272 process, and, you know, I don't want to delve into the intricacies here. It would take too long. But I would just say from my part that's not the type of model that we really want going forward, you know, in all of its dimensions, because it was too much like traditional public utility regulation back when markets were not competitive, we had a monopoly. So we need a dispute resolution process that's quicker, more efficient. It could involve the states, but ultimately it would depend more on mediation and maybe some quicker, you know, baseball style arbitration to resolve disputes for, you know, the things subject to the disputes. For example, like interconnection, which we haven't really spent too much time on.
So, Paul, I know you have to leave soon, so why don't you go next?
Well, I was enjoying the comments there, and then they used baseball for the quick resolution, having just watched some of the World Series. Those games go on forever. I'd take a more calculated approach and move towards soccer. It's 90 minutes, unless it's not. First of all, Andy, I thought your comments were insightful. I think you hit upon a lot of the issues that we have to wrestle with. You know, I'm from a state that is great at Fed bashing. I mean, we've turned it into an art form. But at the end of the day, we recognize that there are certain areas in which the feds need to do their job or we can't do ours. And you also described some of the political conflict that can happen when we get down into the, you know, the grassroots of making decisions on our side of the fence, specifically with our state legislatures, where you can have easily, if it's an election year, a lot of stuff can get passed that is pushed by special interests that are contributing to campaigns, good, bad, or otherwise, and we can end up with a mess. So I think you hit the dynamics of the polls on both sides. So I just want to go back to one thing that I said early on and was echoed by others. I know Dave mentioned it as well. We have an opportunity right now with a brand new chairman, a brand new commissioner, with Mignon Clyburn coming off of being the acting chair, who has been a state regulator, to sit down and have some legitimate discussions about how can we make this cooperative federalism real, as opposed to just something we talk about. And I think that this is the best opportunity we've had in quite a long time. Now, am I going to be so Pollyannic to think that it's going to be perfect? No. Again, without some kind of clear-cut direction from Congress, if there's to be a shift, the commissions, whether it's FERC, whether it's EPA or the FCC, nobody's going to take those jobs to go sit on their hands. They're going to want to move forward. They're going to want to create, for lack of a better word, some type of legacy that represents the time in which they were there, that they had an impact. So they're not going to wait on Congress to do something. But my hope is, as they move forward, that we can be a part of that discussion. And I think that the opportunity for that is really, really good as it's been in years for that to occur. But we can't wait 6 months down the road to have those discussions. I think we need to start moving now. And again, I thought that the question was insightful and did encapsulate a lot of the real concerns that and problems that both the federal and the state sides have if you just give one or the other the complete control.
I think that's a sentiment that we could all agree to. Dave, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I can get behind that. I think Andy, I thought your comments were very good. I think, you know, the thing is, look, there are 50 states, and you don't want to have a patchwork of 50 different regulatory structures overseeing the operation of what are essentially national telecom networks. So you want to focus on what is the role for the states, and I really think the states are, you know, we're the folks that are on the ground here where the consumers are. And I also, when we talk about clarity, we're not talking about a lack of flexibility. We're just talking about tell us what the parameters are that we can operate in. I mean, the fact that we don't have anything from the FCC on the nature of fixed VoIP means that now you have companies going around to state legislators and state legislators spending a lot of time on whether they're going to regulate or deregulate VoIP. And it just seems to me that's a waste of resources. Let's have some clarity from the commission, and that'll help us going forward.
Okay, so Paul, I know you need to run. Thank you for your participation today. Maybe we can take the last question from the call-in audience and wrap this up.
Sure thing. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling. I'm not a legal professional, but I am a Federalist Society member. And I follow this issue because I am a remote, I'm a citizen who lives in a very remote area of Washington State. And we've stayed abreast. We've been on the leading edge of satellite technology since 1985 when we had our first big dish. And it's really interesting for me to watch these discussions about service areas and connectivity and all the rest of it. You know, when I see that the free market has been meeting the needs for years, way ahead of what the regulators seem to even be aware of, there have been grants awarded in our area that would create a service area that's a fiction where almost, I would say, I kid you not, 90% of our remote mountain community has direct satellite communications with Viacom. We beat Comcast in terms of speed, bench speed. And there's a proposal being made that we would have to pay a surcharge for a broadband service that no one would subscribe to. And it's very hard for the public to know where to link in to what it is that's going on in Olympia it seems that the entire process is driven by lobbyists and rent seekers. Is there any way that an opt-out, you know, the legislation would at least at a minimum allow the public to opt out? I know that.
Oh.
That's not necessarily what you were discussing. I'll have to research 271 and 272.
Dave, I think this question's for you.
Well, sure. I'm not familiar with precisely what the proposal is that you're discussing, but I think the overall point is a very good one. I mean, we really have to target to what are unserved or underserved areas, and a lot of times, you know, we are very imprecise in how we're drawing our maps or who we're defining as being underserved. And so we don't want to be imposing costs on people where those costs aren't necessary. We don't want to be attempting to create markets where the markets already exist. And I think that part of that is needing to stay abreast of what the technological changes are. We need to stay abreast of what services are already out there in the communities that folks are claiming to be underserved. And all of this takes a lot of back and forth communication with the communities. Just like we would like the FCC to be in communication with states, a lot of times the states are the state government level doesn't really have communication going with the folks in the local areas. And so we've been trying very hard to make sure that happens. Now, what I believe that the questioner is talking about is some either legislative or local proposals that are going on. And so I'm not familiar precisely with what the proposal is, but I do believe that there is a lot of assumption. There are a lot of assumptions that are being made about the quality of service in areas that actually have more service than we think.
Well, thank you, Dave. I know you need to run now. Why don't we give Randy the final word, and then we'll wrap this up.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks again for hosting. You know, one thing I would say to wrap it up is this. I know the state commissioners have been frustrated about just the ability, from their perspective, to have, you know, quote, a conversation with the FCC and to, you know, have their views heard. And, you know, in the NARUC Cooperative Federalism paper, in a couple places it refers to the FCC's practice of in rulemaking proceedings, you know, how the ex partes, that's the, you know, for those that aren't familiar, that's the, even after comments have been filed in FCC proceedings, that's oftentimes just the starting bell for a series of, you know, visits to the commission and other papers and so forth. And if you're out in the states, you don't have the ability to visit as frequently. I want to actually join with them in saying that I think there's some room for, in one way or another, reforming the ex parte process so it doesn't swallow up what ought to be, you know, the comment and reply comment process. And there's some ways that could be reformed. We'll have another teleform on that. But the final thing I would say is, and I guess this is key, the joint, you know, we referred a couple times to these joint boards, and for, you know, those that may not be familiar, that's a structure created in the Communications Act for federal and state commissioners to focus on issues. Generally there are four FCC commissioners and three state commissioners, and the joint board makes a recommendation, you know, a formal recommendation, and then ultimately the FCC retains the authority to accept it or not. But in there are a couple joint boards that are in existence. But what I take from this conversation and from reading that paper, the Federalism paper, and from listening to Dave and Paul, there are, you know, I think that process, you know, that to create the joint boards and to have the formal meetings and all of that, you know, may be an outdated way of potentially of doing things. I don't know that Paul and Dave would agree with that, but there, you know, in this day and age where things move so quickly and the marketplace is changing so quickly and technology is changing, I just think I take the point that there ought to be more conversations, but maybe there are ways to have those take place, you know, outside of or in addition to the joint board process, and if they took place, if those conversations took place outside of the joint board process, maybe that would be a, you know, a step in the direction of actually realizing a more healthy cooperative federalism. End of that point.
Okay, well, I think we've reached the end of the teleform. I really want to thank the panelists for a very information-filled and practical discussion about getting some clarity on this and getting some discussions put together to see what solutions exist with a joint state and federal model. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dean.
Thank you very much, Greg. And let me add my thanks to our panelists, David Danner, Paul Schlander, Randy May, and a special thanks to our moderator, Greg Sopkin. Excellent job, Greg. Thank you so much. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in and for participating. I encourage you to join our next Teleform conference call Monday at 4 p.m. For a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.